Any other questions about practice and daily life, meditative practice? Please don't be shy.
So I'm still in the looking at what I do every day and mm-hmm. kind of figuring out when I'm acting a certain way and feeling a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm okay now where I can notice something and I'll breathe through it, and I could, if given enough time to do that, you know, because it takes mm-hmm. a bit of time to get over something. Now, what do you suggest in situations where things are coming at you rapid fire, so you really can't have the space that you need to kind of breathe through or work through something? I mean, you know, there's certain situations that you might find yourself in where you don't have the ability to do that.
In these kind of situations, because we don't have to go in, but there would be something like
kids.
What?
Kids.
Yeah, yeah. Kids. So again, for those people who believe that a monastic life or a hermit's life is the direct path to transformation, are wrong. Being a parent is a direct path to transformation. Because you are tested.
Totally
tested. And in that testing, if you have an easy meditative life, you live in a meditation center or something, you know, it's kind of easy, you got lots of space, and, you know, the whole culture there, it kind of makes you think that you're further ahead than you are. But when you're a parent, let's say, or in some kind of frying pan, you don't have that kind of leisure, right? Your stuff is always being pushed. Or not always, although you can hopefully sleep sometimes. Get some sleep, but yeah. So that's wonderful. You know, you don't, when you're in those kinds of, see, to me, those are wonderful situations, and why I think lay practice, if one does it right, it provides great opportunities for transformation, more than the traditional monastic life, because you don't have leisure. It's either sink or swim, right? There's no middle ground, like you're saying. In that moment, you either need to respond appropriately, deal with it appropriately, or all your reactive formations and emotional nonsense and habit energy will just, right? And again, those of you who are listening, it may be different situations than Claudia's, but we all know those situations, okay? And the important thing as lay people is to understand clearly that these times and situations, and this is where we have to be very careful, are not obstacles to practice. See, that's where people go. If only I could get rid of my kids, right? Claudia goes, if only I could get rid of my kids, get rid of my husband, and not work full-time, I could have a great practice, right? Yeah. And that is the way we think, right? All these obstacles in the way of my practice. I could have such a pure practice, right? If I was alone, right? But the thing is, Where better place to develop patience, understanding, mindfulness, letting go, than in those moments, you see? So the first thing I would say to you is, can you begin to see that this path, let's say in this case as a mother, is your spiritual path? Okay, you know, it's not an obstacle to. It's not, how can I get through it with the kids and get onto my cushion, right? Right. Now, again, it's not saying that it's not good to have breaks. But, you know, to watch the mind kind of create that bifurcation, that separation. Right? And instead to clearly see this, you know, these are the people that I am to practice with. My children have been given me to provide me the opportunity to really teach me how to love, how to let go, right? How to be open. Can you see? And so therefore, I'm saying that because we don't realize that in many ways it's the way we even enter situations is already precluding various types of responses. Right? So as a lay person, you want to see all your life, but especially this part of your life, this is your place to practice, and these people are here to teach me, to help me learn, right, how to be, again, more understanding, more compassionate, more laid back, you know, more, okay? So I would say 50% or 60, 70% of how you do is already there by how you're dealing with the situation. Because our traditional way is, when we reach that point, is we resist, right? I don't want to be here. I don't want to have to deal with this. If I have to deal with this one more time, if I have to, right? Can you see? And that is dangerous, because already we're setting up this separation, right? We are resisting. And this practice, you know, you probably heard words like non-duality. It's a big word people like to throw about. But non-duality means no separation. Right? Whenever there is resistance, there is now somebody resisting something. That's the world of duality. It's the world of separation. It's the world, I'm over here and you're over there, right? This is me, this is you, right? And I don't want anything to do with your stuff, right? That's the world of separation. The world of oneness, the world of non-separation, does not see it that way, right? Actually, what happens is this over here disappears. When this is disappeared, then 100% one is what is happening. There's nobody over here not wanting to be there, calculating, having all, you see, all that, you know, I can't take this anymore. You know, but that's all just mental filter. You want to be 100% present to the children, because that's your job, right? I mean, unless you're going to turn it over to somebody else, you see what I'm saying? Or, you know, maybe you can get your husband to spell, or your in-laws, you know what I mean? But when you're there, that's your job, 100%, to be present to the situation, be present to the children in a very open way. No Claudia, which is hard. You know, this is something that takes time to develop. But to really see, where is my suffering come from? And I think when we look deeply, we'll see the suffering's really not coming from the child. The child's just doing their thing, right? The suffering is coming from the Claudia, who doesn't want the child to be doing whatever they're doing. You see? Because in that moment, the child is not performing the way we'd like them perform, right? And we're not happy, are we? We're even worse than unhappy. We get angry, we get bitter, right, you know. And if we're not careful, and we don't realize that whole story is going on where? Inside me. And that's what's getting me ramped up. It's not saying that dealing with children, since I've had a couple of my own, you know, isn't at times, doesn't push you, right? Doesn't push your impatience, doesn't push all these kinds of things. But if one's aware that then what's creating it is me, is myself. And one, therefore, if one can let go of one's agenda and deal with a situation, let's say you have to get out, right? And the kids are just doing their thing. Right, you have your time scale. You know, we got to be at a place certain time, and right, and they are what? God knows. That's a good point, because a lot of young children, God knows where they are, right? But they're definitely not in the world of got to get there on time, right? I mean, that's one thing you know. They do not share that, right? Okay. So that gives you a good start. So you realize we're beginning, I am dealing with somebody who has a totally different outlook on life than I have. And their values are very different, because your values are all about getting there on time, right? And they do not share getting there on time is not a priority value for them, is it? Okay. So you understand that, you know, in a creative way, firm way, you know, but the thing is, how can I get these basically, God knows where they really are. But you know they're not into the world of time and you know, and all that. How can I kind of bring them along? You know, that's your job. How can I kind of slowly socialize them? Carrot and stick, trial and error, you know, and just, you know, the problem with parenting is we take it personally. Right? We take it personally. As opposed to just a lot of it is really just a job. Right? You know what I mean? You know, you're a caretaker, you're a teacher, you're a nanny, you're, you see what I'm saying? A lot of it's a job. It's just kind of functional, isn't it? And so we know with a lot of our functional responsibilities, a lot of our work responsibilities, we should have a functional mind and not have a personal mind that takes things personally. Right? Because when we take things personally, then there is what? Drama. And when there's drama, there is emotionality. And when there's emotionality, there's reactivity. And before you know it, it just becomes a big melodrama. Right? Melodrama is like a big drama. Right? So if we're not careful, we just go from the functional to the little bit of drama, a little bit to, all of a sudden, it's a melodrama. Right? And if we're not careful, it can become a tragedy. So we want to, you know. Yeah. You know, in the early stages of practice, but I think it's a mistake, we see our meditation as an alternative reality to our everyday life. But again, and you know, we talk about this, the whole idea of engaged Buddhism. Our Buddhism needs to be engaged in our daily life. Our mindfulness needs to be engaged in our daily life. And to really see our primary place of practice of mindfulness, of letting go, of compassion, understanding, patience, etc., is all in my daily life. That's where I got to practice. And I got to learn, right in the midst of it, to take that breath. Or just to come back to remind myself. Just, you know, I mean, again, we don't have to make it too difficult, but just to say, you know, because our minds are dangerous. They very easily spin into delusion. Which means, a delusion means it tells us something that's fundamentally not true. The truth of those situations with your children is simply what? That they're children. And they're just acting like children. And they really can't help themselves. See, because we say to ourselves, what? He could not be doing this, right? But the truth is what? He's doing it. Right? We say things like, he should know better. But he doesn't know better. Because there he is. Not knowing better. He's just doing it. But can you see, when we're over here in the world of separation with our own agenda going, you know, he knows better, he's doing this on purpose, he knows I'm in a hurry, and you know what I'm saying? We are just ramping up the drama. Rather than, you know, mindfulness means the capacity to be present. And we want to be present to things as they are, not how we think they are. So when you are present to your sons, right, as they are, you'll see them as they are. And you'll deal with them as they are. And you'll work with them in terms of trying to move them in the direction you'd like them to go, because part of your job is socializing them. Right? You're taking this fairly unsocialized, uncivil little bundle of awareness and energy, right? And you're trying to prepare them, you know, so when they're 15 and 20 and 30, they still don't need you to, you know, be And don't worry, it'll all work out. Right? And it's also time limited. I mean, they do grow up. I can speak from experience, they do grow up. Any other questions? Yes, Mike.
Both of the first questions and both of the subsequent answers hit on an area of my studies and struggles that I've been dealing with in the last few months.
Good.
The first question was, I see we have a tendency to prescribe our path and describe our practice when it should be just the opposite way. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should describe the path and prescribe the practice.
Mm-hmm.
The cultural conflicts with studying a spiritual discipline like Buddhism in a Western culture, it begins with semantics and translation, but it seems to me that it inevitably ends up as a conflict between cultures and the culture where Buddhism evolves, Eastern cultures, which are basically cultures of interdependent beings and societies and communities.
Mm-hmm.
And here in the West, we exalt the individual and the independent self.
Mm-hmm.
So with dealing with others,
mm-hmm.
I would think that in our culture, the cards are almost stacked against us because we're thinking as an independent self, when in an interdependent community, those conflicts would probably never arise. So it's like extra layers of conflict that we have in our practice with dealing with the other, the objective other. And I continue to struggle with this because I'm thinking, if trying to superimpose an Eastern spirituality on my Western self, a self that is involved in Western culture and that exalts the individual ego, it seems to me that I have so many extra layers that I have to get through to for my practice and my relationship with others.
Mm-hmm. So let me just, this is who's in control. So Mike's question is, it's a long question, but just simply is saying, you know, Buddhism developed in cultures where there was much more interdependence. These were more traditional cultures where activities and relationships were all very prescribed. And self was basically minimized. The activity of self in the public sphere was minimized and prescribed. And here we have a culture in the West where it almost seems the opposite, where independence and self-aggrandizement and putting the self forward and advancing the self is more the cultural norm. And so, Michael, well, how do you put those two together when Buddhism comes? And I would say to you, that's a good question. And again, I think that's why I've always enjoyed Thich Nhat Hanh and the way he has traditionally dealt with it. I think less so these days, but traditionally, which is well. First of all, let me just say, please remember that if everything was so wonderful in these more traditional Confucian, everything interrelated, everything interscribed. Don't forget, those are the cultures in which Buddhism developed. So there had to be some problematic stuff going on there that was causing suffering. Okay. So that's important to understand. I mean, that's when you see that, you're getting at the universality, that even though cultures, Buddhism, we could say, developed in a feudalistic time. And yet, I think the core principles are relevant to our post-industrial society. So, to me, the interesting thing, or the great potential of American Buddhism, or Western Buddhism, let's say American Buddhism, is that there is 2,500 years of Buddhism. It is not new. There's 2,500 years of Buddhism, of which 95% of it has been primarily in Asia. So it is very much there are accretions of many cultural overlays that suffuse Asian Buddhism. And yet we find that if we go back to the core teachings of the Buddha, and if we really go to the core teachings of the enlightened masters within the meditative traditions over 2,500 years, we see that there's an inner coherence to the teachings, the realizations, the understanding of the human experience, which seems to be true whether they were Indian or Tibetan or Nepali or Chinese or Korean or Japanese or Sri Lankan. And that's what we need to take. We don't need all the rest. Right, we need the core, the pith, teachings that really facilitate the transformation of the human being. That Buddhism has been working on for 2,500 years. We need to take that, and to really and I think one of the wonderful things that's going on in being an American Buddhist is. See, if you were born in Nepal or China, that's all you would see. Nepal, you think Nepali Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, you know, this is Buddhism. Japanese Buddhism, this is Buddhism. But here, right, I mean, even in Tampa, right, we can go see, oh, there's Thai Buddhism and there's Lao Buddhism and you go to their temples and there's Vietnamese Buddhism and there's Japanese Buddhism and there's Zen and there's Vipassana and there's Theravada and there's Tibetan, right? So you can go to all the, you know, you could just spend a week. You know, just going around Tampa, and you could see a dozen different kinds of Buddhism. And she realized, look at how it's expressed itself. They look so different. You know, you go to a Soto Zen temple, or you go to a Tibetan, and you go, right? Well, you know, take out the cultural stuff. Take out all that, and you get to the core. And in the core, I think you find a lot of similarity, right? Now the question is for those of us who really want to develop an American Buddhism, how do you kind of get rid of all the most, or not all, you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, but get rid of all the non-essential stuff, right? And like you say, take the teachings and the practices of Buddhism and bring them within the culture, our culture. Now, as you say, our culture is not a traditional Asian or Confucian culture where everything is very prescribed and everybody knows their place in society and I know how I greet this one and I know how I greet that one. And you know what I'm saying? You know, it's all, and all social relationships are very tightly controlled by years and years, hundreds and hundreds of years of, you know, just ingrained in the people, right? We're very freewheeling, aren't we? Right? Actually, we're the opposite. Half the time, we don't know how to act. Because people act one way over here, and they act another way over here, and, you know, we have so many subcultures, right? That it's that is why I think Buddhism is wonderful here. Right? Because in this, and again, you know, we know that's why there's such a, there's a certain sector of our society, you know, that are freaked out by the breakdown of traditional social norms. They're freaked out. They're scared, right? And they really want to shut it off and close it off, and they have all kind of judgments about it. Because people don't have a personal practice that allows them to see clearly what's going on and to be present to it without needing a very rigid mental filter to approach. So, I mean, you know, from my point of view, the Buddhist outlook, which is so non-dogmatic, which is so unattached to views, which is so much attentive to the essence of things and the meaning of things and not the form, I think is the teaching for our time. It's not the only teaching for our time. And again, I mean, the fact that here we are in a country that has that celebrates individuality, right? That celebrates dog eat dog and let the top dog win, right? In that culture, there is so much suffering. There is so much unhappiness. How do we know that? How do we know that? Because statistics. You know, if you add up all the people who are depressed, anxious, you know what I mean? It's the new normal, right? Addictions. I mean, you go on and on and on. You know, these are symptoms. These, you know, whatever you call them, you add them all up, and you only come up with one answer. This is suffering. And Buddhism speaks directly to how the individual creates suffering for themselves. As well as Buddhism speaks directly to how to end that suffering. And it speaks directly to self. I mean, that's the central piece of Dharma. That the cause of suffering is this delusion that there is a permanent self. So, I mean, I think psychologically speaking, and again, I would say in a certain way, in other cultures, when Buddhism came to the culture, a lot of the cultures already had religious traditions. A lot of cultures had strong shamanic traditions. You know, so Buddhism kind of adopted to that and used that language. To me, the language of our time is the language of psychology. It's a therapeutic language. We all understand that language. And that, you know, and Buddhism is primarily a psychology. It's a psychological system that talks about the nature of mind, what causes suffering, and how activities of the mind, activities of the speech, communication, activities of the body either create happiness or suffering. That's all that Buddhism really at its core deals with. So to me, it is very relevant to what ails us as a culture, which is a self, you know, the self that was traditionally contained by social norms has been unleashed, and it's not happy. It's not happy, right? It's not happy. We thought, oh, just release, just liberate people from their social norms, right? And they'll be happy, right? So we liberate everybody, right? I mean, we liberated slaves, we liberated women, we liberated Afro-Americans, we liberated So we keep liberating socially, which we could say from a social point of view is whatever it is. I mean, but it's part of our social historical development. But yet we would say, are people happy? In a certain way, we could say they don't have the suffering of when they were, the recipients of injustice, we could say. So in that sense, a certain degree of suffering has been removed. But now that they've entered the mainstream, now they'll just be able to participate in the generalized human suffering of our society. Dissatisfaction. Here we are, right? And there's a great Zen thing where it says, in the midst of water, they cry out, I thirst. Powerful line. In the midst of water, they cry out, I thirst. Look at our society. Right? In the midst of so much stuff. Right? I mean, we all have We all have what? We all have plumbing. Right? I mean, you know that for much of the world, to have indoor plumbing is a big deal, right? We have indoor plumbing, right? We have electricity. Every house is wired. We turn on the electricity, right? I mean, we have washing machines. We don't have to, right? We don't have to wash all the dishes by hand, do we? Right? We don't have to go down to the well and carry the water back, right? We just turn on a faucet. Right? We're cold, we turn on the heat. We're hot, we turn on air conditioning, right? We should be the most happiest people around, shouldn't we? Yeah, we should be by every historical impulse of people who thought. I mean, we can vote, right? Remember, that used to be a big deal. Do you remember that? As we socially developed from tyranny, we thought what? Give human beings the vote. And then what? Then they'll be happy. You know, voting causes misery. Have you noticed that? I mean, democracy causes suffering. I'm not saying democracy is bad, but it's like we need to look deeper. Buddhism gives us the tools. Mindfulness gives us the tools to look deeply. Why? Why, with all these social changes, economic changes, all this, do people suffer, and they seem to suffer more? I mean, it's a hard one to say, but we don't have a lot of reliable data over the past centuries to the degree of people suffering, but just people seem to be so alone. I mean, there are diseases, mental diseases of our age, which perhaps in a certain way we do personally suffer more than in past ages, when life was simpler, when people had less, but people were more connected with family and community and society. But you can't go back, can you? So we have to find ways in the context of our society, right, to create the foundations for people to have meaningful lives, for people to be happy, for people to know how to love and feel loved. Right? I mean, that's why we call ourselves the Florida Community of Mindfulness, right, rather than the Florida Zen Center or Vipassana Center or Meditation Center, because community is so important. Not just simply the practices. Right? I mean, there are many wonderful, fine meditation centers where you go and you sit side by side by side, just like we do here. And you meditate, and then you get up and you leave. And you're learning meditation and taking your life, but there's no community. There's no sense of, that we are in this together, and that we want to create a community of practitioners. Because when people come together, when individuals come together in community, not only are they nurtured, and not only do they have an avenue for nurturing, but they also have an avenue for now taking, let's say, some values. Some meaningful values for our world, and speaking in a more louder, noticeable voice than one can do just as an individual. So it's interesting if you read Thich Nhat Hanh's early. But if you look at his teachings from the 60s and 70s, his writings, he talked about the need to establish communities of resistance, he called them. It was actually a French term. And and that wasn't like political resistance. He didn't mean like that. It meant communities that in the way they interacted and in their values and outlook, they were resisting these more harmful aspects of the popular culture. That, values dog-eat-dog, winner-take-all. That values individuality over community. That values independence over interdependence. That values, taking care of me over taking care of others. So it's important that we see that in our spiritual communities, and not just the Buddhist community. I mean, obviously, we are newbies. There are many wonderful spiritual communities in our society. But it's about fostering a different outlook on life. And then being a kind of an island where other people can take refuge and learn how to love, learn how to be better parents, better husbands, better wives, better partners, better children, better friends, better citizens. Thank you. We'll stop now.